Hello and welcome to this episode of the Ice World podcast. I'm Nadia Frontier and I spent 3 years working across Rothera Research Station on the Antarctic Peninsula and King Edward Point on the sub-Antarctic island of South Georgia. One of the first questions you might ask if you're thinking about applying for a job in Antarctica is whether you can live and work on the icy continent with a medical condition. Our guest today is Dr. Matt Warner, who heads up the British Antarctic Survey's medical unit. He's here to help us understand what the medical assessment process looks like, what conditions can and can't be managed in Antarctica, and what happens when things go wrong. So welcome to the Ice World podcast, Matt. Could you please introduce yourself and tell us how you ended up in the job that you are in today?
So my name is Matt Warner. I'm the medical director for the British Antarctic Survey Medical Unit. I'm an emergency medicine consultant as a background, with a long history of pre-hospital medicine, working in different air ambulances and retrieval systems across the world and in the UK. And I got into this, started work in Plymouth in about 2016. And Plymouth is the hospital in Plymouth is a major trauma center, and it has held a contract for looking after BASA's patients and people south and for the last 28 years now. And I've been very fortunate to join into the crew and over time have become the medical director. So it's a great honour and a privilege and a pleasure to do this as part of NHS work and deliver kind of NHS care for patients.
And does this job currently with working with BASMU, the British Antarctic Survey Medical Unit, occupy 100% of your time, or are you still able to work as what we would imagine a doctor or a consultant to be in the NHS?
It's really important that we still are all clinical, so we are relevant and we know what's going on in the real world of medicine. So my time is best focused. I still spend a lot of my time, about half of my time, doing emergency medicine work or allied work such as trauma, pre-hospital care, things like that.
And as you said, also now you're the director of BASMU, so we'll just use that acronym from now on. So how many directors sit within BASMU?
There is only one director, and that's the medical director. But because it's a medically focused thing, that title means something specific. So, so we tend to rather just use the director of Mystic Medical in front, because I'm not a businessman. I'm not kind of that kind of person. It's more kind of coordinating the medical side of things.
And so what I've witnessed on station is that the doctors that deploy there for a winter or a summer season at Rothera, you are the primary point of contact if they need secondary advice. So essentially, in addition to all of these responsibilities, does that also mean that you're always on call 100% of the time? Because, of course, we can't predict when medical emergencies might occur.
And the answer is yes. The slightly longer answer is that our docs are encouraged to speak to us really early so they can have early support. And I'm the first point of call. Unless I know I'm going to be busy or away, and then I'll nom someone else. But we always have a really good effective cascade system. So let's say the doctor at Rothera, they'll say, I've got a medical case I'd like to discuss. The doctor can just go, yes, I'm available. And we'll pick up the phone. And there's a small team of us that work at Derriford Hospital in Plymouth who spend at least some of their time working for the British Antarctic Survey Medical Units. And so anyone of the team, which is about 7 of us at the moment, will kind of pick up the phone and we can provide remote support. But I tend to be the first point of call. And I'm the one who kind of carries the as it were, the responsibility of the decisions made. So it's easier often if they just speak with me directly.
BASMU is essentially responsible for assessing whether people are fit and well to deploy to Antarctica. So before we get into the detail of exactly what that means, can you set the scene for us? Why is it so important that people are fit and healthy before they go to Antarctica?
Antarctica is the coldest, most remote place on Earth. It's dry, it's one of the driest places on Earth as well. It's loads of physiological stress. It's dark half the year, it's light half the year. And it's a long, long, long way from anywhere that can help you if something goes wrong. Our average medevac time is 7 to 10 days in the summer, and it's even longer in the winter. So the normal stuff that happens day to day in wherever you live, if something goes wrong, you can just pop down to the hospital and get some treatment and you're fine. But if you're lucky, you've got a place that's got a doctor on station, but many places don't even have a doctor. And so what we can't do, a single doctor doesn't make a hospital, doesn't make an intensive care, doesn't make an operating theatre. You need whole teams of people to provide that care. So we need people to be really healthy so that when they do go south, they've got a low chance of something going wrong. We would try and reduce the risk of something going wrong in the general population that's down south. Also, when people do become unwell and they need an emergency medical evacuation, that's risky for them. It can be potentially life-threateningly risky for the team trying to rescue the people. If you try and imagine an air team trying to fly in bad weather, trying to rescue somebody, that puts those people at risk. So you're risking other people's lives. And if it's something that's potentially preventable, that doesn't really make sense. And the other thing is impact to science, impact to people's programs, impact to operation delivery. And you might think, well, that seems quite shallow. But the reality is that if you dramatically impact operations, that can affect safety for everyone else down south. And so you need to think carefully about the impact of a medevac. So we try really hard to reduce the risk of something going wrong, the known risks in that space, and reduce those to a reasonable level. Now, the definition of reasonable is really hard. And trying to work out what's okay and what's not okay is a tricky line that is the main part of my job, really.
Wow. And that baseline gets shifted a little bit because you're in such a remote area as well, being in Antarctica. And I think that's really important to state that the average medical evacuation time is 7 to 10 days. Like that's extreme. Would it actually, maybe you don't know the answer to this, but would it be quicker to evacuate someone from the International Space Station?
Yes, it's a fairly commonly quoted statement, and it's true. If there is a medical emergency on the space station, they have to get somebody out. They can do it more quickly than we can normally do it. So it's quicker to get somebody back from space generally than it is from the space station, at least, than it is from south.
Just highlights the absolute importance of your job and also the remoteness of the Antarctic stations. So when we talk about this assessment process before going down, so that would occur during pre-deployment training where successful candidates have a kind of assessment by one of your BASMU doctors. What does someone go through when they're being evaluated? Is there anything particular that would be different to somebody living in the normal world?
Yeah, so for them, if you have to have a medical for any kind of work thing, it will feel fairly similar, but many people don't have to have a medical for their work. So I'll describe what happens. It starts off with an initial form, which people have a look at and decide, and they essentially see if they've got conditions which we just can't look after south. And they have a look at that form and just tell us if there's something that crops up on that form so that we can then have a talk with them and work out if this is something that we can support or not. Then they fill out a fairly extensive medical questionnaire and ask us all about their background, current problems, and what issues might become relevant to being south. And that is from physical conditions to mental health conditions. And so it's a very broad-ranging form. And then we have a medical process where you're actually seen by a medical doctor and examined and have a thorough medical examination of all your different systems. And again, that's trying to find things that you didn't know about yourself that might be an issue and try and prevent those becoming an issue. So if we can fix them and then get somebody south, that's perfect. That's exactly what we want to do. That's the main aim, is we want to help people get south and we want people to be healthy. Part of the next process is a dental assessment. And if people aren't just going for summer, then it's a relatively quick process going to see your dentist, and you get a form signed off to make sure that they're happy that you're dentally healthy. But if you're going to be overwintering, then you have to have really quite an extensive dental assessment and treatment plan if necessary, just to make sure you're really healthy from a dental side of things before going down. Because we don't have individual dentists. Our doctors go through a week-long dental training course, but it doesn't necessarily turn them into a dentist. And then all those forms come together and myself or one of my senior colleagues reviews them and we have a look at all the information. And sometimes we go, yeah, that's fine. And sometimes we go, oh, let's find out more about this or that. And we write back to the person. We sometimes contact the person's GPs or specialists that they've seen Sometimes we'll get international, we'll get expert advice on something. It might need that they need specialist tests or investigations or treatments to make sure they're as safe and as stable as we can ensure before they go south. And a very small number of people that does require treatment or bits and pieces before they go. And again, an even smaller number of people, it means that they have something which we can't support south, and they can't deploy, which is sad. Because quite impactful, and it's hard for them, but it's important that we do have a line somewhere, and we do make sure that people are as healthy as they can be.
And limit that chance of medical evacuation. Is there an age limit in terms of people that you screen during that assessment in pre-deployment training?
They have to be adults. That's the only age limit at the moment. We do know that certain medical conditions are more prone as you get older. And so age becomes part of a risk factor calculation for certain things. But age itself is definitely not a cutoff or anything like that. So you can have we have lots of older, very, very healthy people that are far healthier, fitter than I am, I'm sure. And they deploy in a fabulous way every year and do lots of amazing science. So yeah, age is not a thing. In terms of it by itself, but we do know it does have some predispositions or relevance to certain conditions that makes us look at things more carefully just to make sure they are super healthy.
And also, you then had to go through that really rigorous process during the time of the COVID pandemic. Important and crucial Antarctic science was still occurring during that 2020 and beyond lockdown. Were there any specific extra levels of criteria that you then had to apply to the cohort of people going down that maybe had factors that were less susceptible to COVID?
So we spent a lot of time in that period, a huge amount of time looking at all the data that was coming out and examining of the people who were getting COVID, who was getting it badly, who was getting it severely, who was needing to go to hospital, who was going to intensive care, who are the people that are most at risk of dying. And you need to understand that if you need intensive care when you're south, that means that you're basically not going to survive. We don't have a hospital. We've got one doctor. We don't have an intensive care. So if you need intensive care to stay alive, and a lot of people in the COVID time did, then you were not going to survive. So it was really important for us to try and work out who are those people that were most at risk. And I was very very fortunate. Part of my role is that I represent the UK in the international medical community in the Antarctic. And we have meetings together as an international body of doctors and specialists. And I led a lot on the COVID work and the COVID research. And looking at what we did, the data that was coming out, we quite relatively quickly installed what I call the fire break. And that means that when you were going to go south, you had to be isolated for a period of time before you then went south. Well, the reason for that isolation and that period of time is that if you had the bug, it likely would die out before you die out of your system, and you wouldn't be infectious by the time you then went south. And that's really important, that whatever the pre-screening we did, then they had this last event, this fire break to allow to burn out of anybody that was in their systems, and that when they went south, they weren't going to be taking us out, they weren't going to be spreading it around. Because when it gets down to base, it's havoc. There were medical conditions which made you more prone to having severe COVID, which means needing intensive care. And those medical conditions we excluded from heading south. So we tightened up those criteria a lot, to make sure that the people who were going south was as well as possible. And if they were going to get up, the chance of them having a severe COVID was really low. That was hugely impactful on the sides. That was hugely impactful on operational delivery. And we reduced the number of people that were going south a lot, because keeping the lights on is really important, and base, keeping things turning over is really important. But keeping people safe south is also important. You're trying to balance medical risk and operational risk. And yeah. It was really challenging, but through what we did, we had no cases of COVID through the whole time that there was no vaccine available. That's really important. We knew that in the pre-vaccine days that we were looking at possibly quite a high early mortality rate. Now, you think nowadays it's sitting around flu, but actually
even 1% of your population dying south is a lot of people. Look at 5% of your population dying south is a lot of people. It's hugely impactful. It would have been terrible. So the fact that we managed through what we did is we had no cases of COVID at all. And we were swabbing people regularly south. And we did actually a virology study on that. And we tracked and we know we had no COVID in that space during that time. We just happened to be running a virus study when it's all kicked off. So we were kind of well set off. So that was a remarkable achievement. I don't know of the other international spaces, of the other international programs, how many managed to be COVID-free at all. So what we did worked, but it was really impactful.
So potentially, in some cases, people could stay for the summer season, but not over winter. Can you give us a bit more of a sense of where those lines might be drawn? We've talked about the dental assessments that are less rigorous between summer and winter, but would there be any other criterias?
We know that in the summer, generally, as I say, we've got 7 to 10 days time to get people out. In the winter, it can be weeks or months. That's changing, sadly, for climate. But it's still much harder and much more dangerous to get people out. So we need to have reassurance that if a person has a condition over the winter, it's much more stable than a condition over the summer, where we do have some window to get people out. There are few conditions which are fine for summer but not fine for winter. Those conditions that people do have, because everybody's got stuff, everybody's got a problem, things aren't right with them, what most people do, is that we need more assurance of stability for a winter deployment. A good example might be, for example, psychology, so mental health. Mental health is a really big area, and knowing that a person, if, for example, a person has depression, if a person is going to be overwintering, we'd want to know and have a really good idea that their mood was really stable, and preferably they'd worked it and the medications they were on had been stable for a long period of time, and preferably they'd worked in remote communities, small communities before, and even better if they worked in those spaces in areas where you got the physiological stresses of kind of long time day, long time night, and the kind of enclosed space that is living in the Antarctic. We want a really much more reassurance that that person's depression was really quite stable before we thought about kind of stability and safety for them and those people around them for an overwinter. Whereas in the summer, we may not need quite so much reassurance that things were quite as steady. We'd still want them to be steady, and we still want a degree of assurance, but maybe we'd need less assurance.
On most of the stations, the population increases by at least twofold. So that also makes the society feel a little bit more relaxed rather than a very, very intense winter community. Mm. And so even with the most rigorous screening, emergencies and accidents do still happen. We've all been witness of them. So what does a response look like when something goes wrong and somebody needs to be medically evacuated? Is there a specific pathway, and what are the methods, such as aircraft or ship-based evacuations?
Most of the cases where somebody's injured, the first aider is the person that's next to you, or perhaps yourself if you're well enough. And that's a really big part of our training that we would give to people before they head south, is that they do lots and lots of first aid training. It's really important to us that everybody who heads south is able to look after themselves and each other. It's a really high training schedule. And the first rescue, the first aid, is delivered by people who had endorsed training that we've delivered. Then if you're lucky and you're in a space where there's a doctor or a basement medic, then they will turn up with their extra gear that we supplied, and they will do their bit to stabilize the injury and to make the person comfortable working with the team that are already with that patient. They then get on the phone to us, normally me, and say that a person has an injury, and quite quickly we'll understand that this person needs to be medevaced. So from a medical side, I then start providing medical advice, ensuring that the person is stable, and making a plan for the medical repatriation, work out which hospital they should be going to, what their needs are likely to be, and which country in the world that might be our first port of call for the initial treatment before their person gets home.
And I'm making a plan quite quickly based on where the patient is, what their likely medical needs are, and where the best place for them is. At the same time, often the base station leader at the place where the person's injured will pick up the phone and speak to the BAS executive or grown-ups at Cambridge. And they will let them know that there's been an incident and that the person, for example, might need to come out. I then coordinate with the BAS ops on call, and that's the operations manager and the senior executive within BAS. And I don't need to say medical stuff, as in tell what's wrong with the patient, unless the patient has specifically said it's fine, or if the patient agrees that it's medically relevant to the evacuation, because there are some conditions that come with them specific requirements. And we'll always get permission from the patient if we're going to reveal any information. But otherwise, there is a medical issue and I need to get this person out. And I say to BAS, I need to get this person to this hospital, for example. And they'll go, okay. And they'll do everything they can to help get that patient out, which sometimes can be, if you're Rotherer, then you might have access to an aircraft, which is great because that makes things more quicker. And other times it might be that you don't have an aircraft or you're on an island that only has ship support. And the SDA might, so the Sedaven Atterborough might be there and you can use that ship. But also you may well not have the SDA around and we might need to ask a passing tourist vessel, for example, to assist, or another national Antarctic program to assist. And that does happen both with air support and ship support. So as an international community, we work closely together to coordinate the rescue and movement of that personnel, dependent on severity of injury and speed, need for speed. How sick is this person? How quickly do we need to get them out to achieve a low impact to their long-term health or their survival? And that then directs how much we need to kind of reach out to others to support us and what we need to do to move that patient out. So Rotherer is the only place. Either you will fly to Rotherer, and then from Rotherer, you'll fly out. That's your preference. Ships take so much longer. They take many, many days. But there are some islands and some places that can only access by ship.
And that's difficult because the doctor can't leave the station. So, like, you know, obviously, if you go in an ambulance, you've got paramedics with you that are supervising the patient. But then in this case, this scenario, you really have to put the patient on that ship of an external operator in some cases. And I mean, I suppose they might have a doctor on that ship who can also look after the patient, but it's different responsibilities.
It's really complex. We can't just take the doctor away, the senior doctor away from Rotherer, for example, and leave 100 whatever people alone without medical support. So and then part of some quite complex discussions and formulations with the BAS team about how to make this as safe as possible. And that you raise a really important point. Sometimes the quickest route out isn't necessarily the best route out. And it might be that we will send one of our senior doctors down from the UK or another person in from somewhere else and provide medical support. And we've definitely done that. We've tasked medics from nearby countries to assist and to be a medical support. And we've also flown our own doctor down from the UK previously to get somebody out. It depends on the situation, but it is really complex sometimes making those judgment calls and getting those equations right.
And what happens if it's the doctor that's the person that needs the medical evacuation? If they're the person that gets sick, then what happens?
Yeah, and they do. Doctors do get sick. And one, recognizing that you're unwell isn't always easy. And secondly, the doctor is as prone to injuries as any other human being. We hold them to a high degree of responsibility, so we tell them they need to be grown-ups. But stuff happens. And fortunately, we spend a lot of our time training people around us. It's not just the doctor that provides the initial medical care. As I said earlier, everyone gets advanced first aid training before they go south, but a small number of people get a load of extra training so that they are really clued up and be really helpful. And we have had problems before where our doctors have been quite significantly injured and needed treatment that was provided by those first aid trained people around them. I dialed in remotely and provided remote medical support. But these people did a great treatment and provided great care for their doctor that was because of the training that they'd received. So these were, you know, scientists and planners and mechs. These wasn't their day job, right? And they did great. So it does happen, and the training that they received beforehand and during means that they are able to provide pretty good first aid for that laptop.
Yeah, shows that the training must be effective. That is impressive. Yeah. And let's talk about, again, the doctors themselves. The station doctor, generally, do they come from an A&E emergency response background? Do they have to have any specific requirements in order to be a doctor of a station, which, as we've said, is a very big responsibility? You could have one doctor for 160 people in Rothera.
Yeah, so we take doctors that have had to have been a doctor for a good few years already. So they know their edges. They know what they know, and they're quite good understanding when they're running out of knowing. So they ask early. That's really important. And we like to have doctors who've got a broad range of backgrounds. Ideally, they spend time in the emergency department in England. They understand English systems and NHS care delivery, and they understand the kind of rigors of emergency work. If they've done GP in the background, that's great. That's really useful. We don't only say they can only be an emergency doctor, but what's more important is they've got a broad background of skills. We mostly take doctors that are still in training, i.e. they're still in their learning phase. They're registrars, they're senior doctors, they're not consultants yet. They're not specialised in just one area, because I don't really want to have a doctor that's specialised in earlobes, for example, to be the one doctor at Rothera who can only look at people's earlobes but hasn't got a clue when it comes to eyebrows. So we want a person who's got that generalised understanding of medicine and that broad range of need. And then they join us and they spend 6-7 months with us having a really, really broad education. So they spend 7 months or so just training, just learning. And we take them through loads. We teach them dentistry, radiology, how to take x-rays, which doctors don't know how to do. So we teach them how to do that. Well, so we do lots. We cover loads and those good things that they may not be fresh on when they come and join us, but by the time they leave, they've definitely got a toolbox full of useful things where they deploy.
It is the most extensive training of any role on station. 7 to 8 months of full-time work based at Plymouth and Derriford Hospital is pretty intense, and compared to exactly all of the other roles, there's just not that same level that is directed specifically to deploying to an Antarctic station. Of course, everyone has to have skills and competencies, but such an extensive level it just demonstrates how important that responsibility is.
Yeah, you're right. And I think that's, so they do, forgive me, that it's not full-time, as they do a little bit of, they do some medicals for BAS, so they'll come to Cambridge sometimes and do some medicals, and they will join us in delivering some of the first aid training. But you're right, it's a huge amount of time and a huge commitment, a huge financial commitment, because it's so important. Keeping people safe is really important. We really take senior doctors and then we invest in them so that they are even more skilled and they've got a really big toolbox. And of the international space, I think we're probably the one that invests most in that phase of training. And it's one of the most important bits of what we deliver, I think, for BASS's people is the training of our doctors. So I think you're right to point it out, and it's a key thing.
And Matt, have you yourself been to Antarctica?
Oh, I've been really lucky. Yeah, I've been loads, and it's brilliant. So I've visited all of our stations, and it's been a huge privilege, and it's important, because as fun as it is to see seals and penguins and those kinds of things, the reality is that it's understanding the space that we're working in and delivering the medicine in. And when I go, that's why I go, is to essentially quality control, to look at what we're delivering, is to understand the spaces that we're currently in and the current risks of those spaces. And so I've been very fortunate to spend time at all of our stations and all our bases. And I worked with one of the doctors on the Shackleton for a while, and I was also been on the James Clark Ross, and recently have managed, been lucky enough to spend a little bit of time on the SDA. So I love being at sea. So particularly my Shackleton experience, that was a great cruise, and being the dock aboard was fabulous. I loved working with them, the marine team, a really important part of our teamwork, that we the delivery of science and operations
And a great time to see the new building at Rotherham. I was there recently, and the new building is amazing. It's an amazing surgery. So I've been really lucky to have been down quite a lot.
So to wrap things up, for anyone who is listening to this and thinking about applying for a job in Antarctica and maybe is a little bit nervous about whether they'd make it through the medical assessment process, what would you like them to know?
Our role in medicine as the medical team primarily is to assist the delivery of science for us. It's to deliver the science, the program, the operationals. Our role is to get people south who are healthy and to help you stay healthy. It's important to know that when people fill out medical forms or have contact with us, is that who they're dealing with, they're not dealing with British Antarctic Survey as itself, the place based in Cambridge, part of NERC and UCRI. What they're dealing with is the NHS. So this is an NHS organisation. It is part of a University Hospital Plymouth, which is a trauma centre down in the southwest. We are completely separate electronically and in every legal structure way, separate to us. And that's really important that people know that their notes are being dealt by people who have the right to access medical information, but also have the responsibility of accessing it in a responsible way, according to all the GDPR and GMC best practice legal frameworks and guidelines. The notes are held completely separately to BAS. BAS can't access it even if they wanted to. And we do have access to your NHS records and NHS systems because we are part of the NHS. And when you supply us information that may go back directly to your GP or go, for example, radiology, go into that you have a record in the NHS, what's called the spine, so a network of information, where your information is kept securely part of the NHS system. People might worry about confidentiality, but please be assured that we are a hospital and we deliver hospital-based level care with all the kind of security and systems that fulfill those requirements as well. So it's separate and we treat your information with respect because we should. It's part of our day job. And it's really important that you know that we can treat things in an appropriate way that doesn't get back to BAS is health secret. Humans get stuff wrong with them. That's normal. And whether that be a physical thing or a mental health thing, that's okay. And many, many conditions we can support really well and safely in the Antarctic space. It's fine. There's a broad range of problems and we support those. And if you have a problem, talk to us early and we will then work with you to try and work out whether you can mitigate that risk or not. And for almost everyone, we can. And for a small number of people, we can't. But that's okay. It's important that we do have lines in the sand to keep you and everyone else south safe. So don't be scared of the medical process. It's there to understand risk and then help support that, mitigate it when we can, and understand it and support it and to support the kind of bigger picture of which you're going to be part. So I hope you do apply. I hope you have an amazing time. You're part of something much bigger than just you. You're part of kind of humanity's work to understand what we're doing to our planet and to move science and humanity forward. So it's a great thing to be part of, and understand that we're there to help support that.
And finally, what is one thing that you wish everybody knew about Antarctica?
It really is changing so fast, and it's sad to see. And people know it on a book level. They know, they hear the stories, they go, oh, the ice is melting. They hear the stories that this climate is changing. But when you go down there, in just a few years, you see how much is changing and how fast. It's so sad. And people know it on a brain level. I wish that people could feel it. They could go down there and just feel the visceral feeling of what we're doing to our planet. And both the Arctic, which I've also been to, and seeing how rapidly that space is melting, and what we're doing to even Rotherham in the last few years that I've been going down, is changing. And it's really, really sad to see. I wish that people really understood the impact that we're having on our planet.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you so much for your time and also for giving us a real deep insight into the medical process and what it's like to just deal with medical conditions, which we all have in Antarctic, isolated, remote places. Thank you.
A great pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity and have a great day.
Thank you again to Dr. Matt Warner, Medical Director at the British Antarctic Survey Medical Unit, for his insight into how the unit functions and how nothing is overlooked when it comes to the health and well-being of those working across BAS. Next time, we're marking one of the most significant events in the Antarctic calendar and the final episode of the Ice World podcast with a midwinter episode, a special day marked by a turning point in the winter darkness as sunlight starts to return to the continent. It's celebrated across all of the British Antarctic Survey bases with traditions and rituals from the simple to the silly to mark the occasion. And if you enjoy Ice World, tell us. Make sure you like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so that anyone and everyone fascinated with what life is like in the Antarctic will be able to find it. I'm Nadia Frontier, and thank you for listening.